Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 4:03 p.m. that is Central Time. Today is Friday, so it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And today is January 7th. And this week was characterized by a big move in bonds. So the five-year yield is up to 1.5%. It's completely unwound the big compression that we saw at the beginning of 2020. In that time, the quantity of debt has increased by about a quarter. So that necessarily means that the cost of servicing the debt has increased by a similar amount over the course of the last year. And then we have the Federal Reserve minutes came out. And there's a couple of different ways of interpreting it. The first is that everything they had to say was already in the price. But that's clearly not the case, because the bond market did not respond or didn't ignore what the Fed had to say. And I think a good part of the reason for that is because they are starting to talk about balance sheet runoff. And the two things that they had to say were quite alarming from the perspective of bond investors. And the first of those is that they anticipate that balance sheet runoff would occur quicker than last time round, and secondly, that it would be faster than last time round. So they're not going to wait as long before they introduce it, and when they do introduce it, they're going to be more aggressive. Well, we have now got plenty of examples of what quantitative tightening does, because let's look at that period between the end of 2017 and really all the way through until 2019, we had quantitative tightening, and the size of the Fed's balance sheet contracted. So then we can also think about, what did the stock market do in 2018? And the conditions that we're seeing now are not all that dissimilar to what we saw back in 2018. We had two good-sized pullbacks, one of 10% and another of 20%. Now, quantitative tightening didn't end until about the middle of 2019, but they stopped raising interest rates at the end of 2018, and the size of the balance sheet started to trend back upwards again from that time. So of the total assets central banks' balance sheet started to trend upwards in 2019, even though the Fed's balance sheet didn't in fact stop contracting until a few months later. So one thing that we can certainly say is that during the period of quantitative tightening, stock markets didn't do especially well. Well, of course, we also know that the other central bank that has been most aggressive in quantitative tightening has been the European Central Bank. And between 2012 and 2014, they took €1 trillion out of circulation. So let's just look at what stock markets did in between 2012 and 2014. And we can see clearly that stock markets went up in that time, but there was a couple of wobbles along the way. So then we should also think about, what did currencies do during those time frames? When a central bank is reducing the quantity of currency outstanding, well, then you would anticipate that the currency should rise. And that's exactly what happened with the euro. And it's exactly what happened we can simply just look at the euro the other way around. In 2018, the euro fell and the dollar appreciated when the USA was engaged in its own quantitative tightening program. So now we're in an interesting situation, because the dollar has been appreciating all year, and inflationary pressures in Europe, they're probably peaking. It looks like they've peaked in Germany already, and there was a very large inflation figure was posted in here today, upwards of 5% on the CPI for Europe. So Obviously, that has raised the specter of potentially that Europe will also engage in some form of tightening measures. So we may not see the dollar appreciate in an aggressive manner if the ECB were to follow its lead and start raising interest rates or reducing the quantity of liquidity being provided. But they're certainly not going to do anything in a hurried manner. They're much more likely to wait until the Federal Reserve does something first. So we've looked at currencies and we've looked at stock markets, but it's also worth looking at bonds. So if we look at the bond market, it would be reasonable to anticipate that if central banks stop buying bonds, well, that's removing a source of demand from the market and yields should rise. And even in an environment which has been characterized by the trend downwards towards negative yields in Europe, yields did rise in 2012 and 2013, and they also rose in the USA back in 2018. They rose by about 75 basis points. And a good part of the reason for that, of course, was because the Federal Reserve was raising interest rates. So it was a 20% pullback on Wall Street chastened the Fed last time round. They had been raising rates and engaged in quantitative tightening during the period of the Trump tax cuts because they were worried about overheating, because they were so pro-cyclical. And the economic growth had been positive for years already. So they were being really cautious. Well, then the stock market pulled back by 20% right at the end of 2018, and the Federal Reserve changed their mind. And then they started to greatly increase the supply of money into the market. And they also started to become more aggressive because of challenges with the high yield market and then the repo market. The repo market alone required $450 billion to be injected overnight. Well, I think it's important that high yield prices are rolling over. They've been holding a sequence of lower rally highs now for the last couple of quarters, and it was in negative territory again in here today. Relative to bonds, however, this spread, or relative to treasuries, the spread remains reasonably well contained. But there's also a sequence of higher reaction lows here. Generally speaking, it is moves above 500 basis points are when investors start to become anxious about rising yields on the high yield sector. But because so many companies had the opportunity to refinance over the course of the last year, well, then there won't be quite the same funding wall that's an impending risk in 2022 or probably even 2023. But the kinds of companies that certainly do have an ongoing requirement for liquidity and are heavily impacted by rising yields are the SPACs. And the index was down 100 points over the course of the last 6 weeks. It's an acceleration of the downtrend that's been underway since February, and there's every reason to anticipate that this will continue lower for as long as yields march higher. But of course, the big question in terms of global liquidity is what will the various central banks do? I think it's unlikely the Federal Reserve is going to demur from their policy of quantitative easing, then an interest rate hike, and talking about quantitative tightening. The ECB isn't going to do anything until the Fed does something. So that then brings us, of course, to what is China going to do? So when we look at the size of the central bank, balance sheet, it leaped higher in 2020, and then it persisted higher in 2021. And obviously, the Federal Reserve is going to be a very significant weighting within it, but the reality is that capital is global and mobile, and that if one central bank is printing money more aggressively than others, well, that's going to represent a tailwind for risk assets. So at the moment, we're at a point where central banks are talking about removing the accommodation, but we're still in an accommodative environment. So the total assets of central banks continues to march higher. But it did decline in the period up to 2019. So even then, we had less activity from global central banks, and that was a contributing factor in rising volatility in the stock market overall. Then, when we think about what's going on in China, well, the credit impulse in China is, I think, beginning to turn. Now, it generally tends to turn with a good lead relative to the performance of the stock market, and it's coming from depressed levels overall. So we've had a really considerable contraction in the credit impulse in China, and you can see also from the chart that it's very cyclical, so that we get peaks about every 3 or 4 years, and then the troughs occur with intervals too of about a couple of years. So at the minimum, we're at an important low, and potentially we're going to start to see credit moving back upwards again. Well, this entire episode of weighing on the property sector isn't going to last indefinitely, but I suspect that what we're being shown by the performance of the various property sectors in China is that the private sector is going to take over. Now, Chinese equities, and particularly those listed in the USA, were among the worst performers last year. So when we think about the Nasdaq Golden Dragon China Index, it was down about 60% last year. And now it's beginning to steady from the lower side of the range that formed between 2019 and early 2020. So, if China steps in and begins to support global liquidity by printing, well, then that's going to be something that should be quite beneficial for stock markets and for risk assets more generally, because it would factor through into the total assets of central banks, and it would ensure that the trend remains going up and to the right. Of course, if China decides that they don't want to rescue the economy and that they want to instill pain in order to squeeze out all the leverage, well, then we're not going to have the same quantity of liquidity, and the stock market would languish. But considering the kind of economic pain that would be required to squeeze out all of the leverage, well, I just don't believe that China has that appetite. So it's quite likely that we're in a trading environment. I did notice this week that Jeff Gundlach said that he doesn't believe that China is an investable market, and I'm very much of that opinion, and I've been saying it for years. But that doesn't mean it's not a trader's market, and if for a trade from a trading perspective, it's really very oversold. So there's clear scope that we're going to see some additional upside from here. And then we have India. where the Nifty has rebounded really rather emphatically from the region of the trend mean. So this is still a consistent trend, and it continues to range with one consolidation above the last. And we've had a meaningful rebound from the region of the trend mean over the course of the last 3 weeks. This is also occurring at a time when the rupee has been quite steady, and it has returned now to test the dollar sequence of higher reaction lows. The one, I think, important characteristic for a large number of the emerging markets is that they have plenty of experience dealing with inflationary pressures. So they have the capacity to grow past inflationary pressures, whereas much of the rest of the world, particularly the developed world, doesn't quite have that same opportunity. And India is now at the beginning of a new credit cycle as well. It's perhaps a little bit further along than China is. And it is at the point where the demographic dividend is going to be most benign. There are hundreds of millions of young people in India looking to enter the workforce and achieve a better standard of living overall. So that should set up India as an important export, or an important exporter of manufactured goods, and there will likely be a significant trend of building factories in India. And one of the, I think, the unique factors about India for years was that the vast majority of factory workers were men, and that the labor force participation for women in the economy was comparatively small. But everywhere else in the world, the majority of people working in the textile industry are women. But of course, that would also imply that the kinds of jobs that the men are doing would also increase and start to draw that workforce away. So it's perhaps representative of how underdeveloped India's manufacturing sector is that the vast majority of repetitive work is being done by men, and particularly in the garment business. If the Indian rupee can strengthen through 74 and break the dollar sequence of higher reaction lows, then that would really be very benign for the stock market, because it would give international investors both capital market and currency market appreciation. Then we can also think about what's going on in Japan. The Nikkei index has been quite volatile, and it was down this week, and it's been ranging for most of the last year. But the Japanese yen is trending lower. And the US dollar broke out to new recovery highs against it this week. Now, we're probably going to get some consolidation because we have a short-term overbought condition. But this looks like an uptrend, and it has very clearly broken a pattern of underperformance that's been evident since the peak of the low for the yen back in 2015. So Japan has no intention of walking back its quantitative easing program. China is on the cusp of potentially initiating a fiscal stimulus. Europe is looking at worrying inflationary pressures, but perhaps less so in terms of the future. And the USA is the most active in attempting to curtail speculative interest, particularly in risk assets. So, generally speaking, a period of quantitative tightening is positive for the currency, it's negative for bonds, and it's mixed for stocks. Because, and this is generally the case, that people don't volunteer to really engage until they have a reason to. So when we think about the stock market, stock markets will persist higher as long as there's plenty of liquidity. Now, when liquidity gets drawn down, like during a period of quantitative tightening and raising interest rates, well, then the impetus behind stocks will be more focused on earnings and growth. And corporate earnings are still strong. So we're still in a reasonably benign environment in terms of those earnings. But, and in fact, that those earnings are right at all-time highs. So when we think then about where stock markets might go, generally speaking, stocks do reasonably well, but they're prone to volatility during a period of quantitative tightening. So that's potentially what we can anticipate, that during 2022, it's going to be similar to what we saw in 2018, that the stock market did reasonably well the vast majority of the time, but then didn't. And those periods when it didn't were entirely down to Jay Powell. The first time was when he took office and the market pulled back by 10%. And that was normal. And it's quite normal for the stock market to be volatile following the taking up of office of a new Fed chairman or chairperson, because the market wants to know that the central bank has its back. So when you get a new central bank governor, then the market sells off. People wanted to know, was there a Powell put? And they found out that there was. And then the stock market started to rally again. Then in about October of 2018, Jay Powell said that interest rate hikes are on autopilot. And nobody liked the sound of that. And the stock market pulled back by 20%. And Steve Mnuchin convened the plunge protection team by calling together all the investment bank CEOs on Boxing Day. And Jay Powell made some calming statements and stopped raising interest rates. So then the stock market bottomed and recouped its losses in quite short order and pushed on to new high ground. So I suspect that we're in for a similar type of scenario on this occasion. Well, quantitative tightening means removing dollars from circulation. So it was benign for the currency. And then in 2018, gold prices, they went down in the early part of the year and then recouped most of the loss by the first quarter of 2019. So we can also then conclude that it had a mixed effect on gold. But the worst performing asset during a period of quantitative tightening was Bitcoin. And we had one of the Bitcoin winters from the peak in 2017 down to the lows in early 2019. And the price went from 19,000 and change to about 3,000. So Bitcoin fell approximately 85%. And obviously now we're back in the region of 40,000. And you have people like Mike Novogratz talking about the potential for Bitcoin to find support somewhere between $40,000 and $38,000. And we're really not all that far away from it. And we're in the region of a previous area of support as well. But other than that, it's not a consistent trend. And we have the big failed upside break back in November. So then the big question is, are we going to see anything other than just mild steadying in this area, or are we going to see additional unwinding of leveraged positions? Certainly, Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies have achieved a significant following, but ultimately, I think the vast majority of people are in the market specifically for fast profits. And we're not getting many of those right now. And Ethereum, having failed to sustain the move above 4,000, has pulled back to test the region of the 200-day moving average and the 3,000 level. So we have a short-term oversold condition, but we're going to have to see a bounce. But the weakness that's coincided with the weakness in the bond markets and in risk assets more generally, that's supportive of the view that Bitcoin's a risk asset and gold is a store of value asset. And then the other potential store of value asset is oil. And oil prices remain quite firm. Now, every time oil prices have pushed above the $80 level in the course of the last 7 years, it's failed. So if this breakout's going to hold, and then we're going to have to see or I guess the other way of thinking about this is oil prices have been ranging below $80, and they're currently above $80. And if this breakout holds, well, then we're back in a demand-dominated environment for the medium term. Now, it's not like we don't know where the oil is. There's plenty of oil around. We don't have the kind of supply and elasticity for oil that we do for copper, for example. But at the same time, producers have never had a more uncertain demand profile. And demand historically has been the easiest thing for them to monitor because they had economic growth figures and they could track pretty closely the correlation between demand for oil and demand for other goods and services in an expanding economy. So demand was the constant around which supply was variable. But today we have variable demand and variable supply. So that is going to contribute to a more uncertain environment. And from the perspective of producers, what it means is that there's an additional risk premium on the market that needs to be justified in order to spend the money necessary to build new wells and bring new oil to the market. And if oil prices continue rising from here, they'll quite likely get up to test the $100 area. And that is a point potentially at which some demand destruction might begin. And it would also be a rather profitable position for the vast majority of the energy producers. I remember back in 2020, right in the teeth of the pandemic, ExxonMobil had a yield of 12%. What I also find particularly interesting is the correlation right now that we're seeing between Exxon and the 5-year yield. So it has now completely unwound the big compression from during the pandemic. We've definitely seen that Europe is praying for a mild winter and has been scrambling to try and find additional cargoes. So the UK natural gas price has come back down to the £200 level, and I think it's unlikely that we're going to see prices come back into the base formation. This is a new price environment, and there is still the potential that supply from the Ukraine or through the Ukraine is going to be constrained, that Russia is going to become more aggressive. They're going to try and push their geopolitical position. So that's going to continue to put upward pressure on natural gas prices because there's a geopolitical premium on the market, and Europe in particular is not spending the money necessary for significant new storage facilities. On the other hand, they are spending money on batteries and energy storage facilities. But the big difference between copper and oil is that it takes decades to bring a new copper property online, and not least because most of the potential is in places that are really very inaccessible. So then you also have to build the rail networks, the port facilities to export the iron ore. And then, of course, some countries don't want ore exported. They only want finished products exported. So that's obviously an additional headwind to supplying or sourcing first the capital necessary to build a world-class mine. So copper prices continue to pause around the 200-day moving average. And it looks likely that we're going to see it trending higher over the course of the next couple of years. This has the hallmark of a secular bull market. Now, when we think about what could drive a secular bull, with transportation companies cropping up everywhere, and we had Sony announcing this week that they've set up an EV vehicle division. Tesla is priced as if it's going to be producing every car in the world within the next decade. But I think it's also relevant that Tesla's a major liquidity acquirer, and it's a haven for liquidity when liquidity price rates are growing quickly. But when that liquidity starts to become more expensive, then it's these liquidity magnets tend to underperform. So Bitcoin's underperforming and Tesla's pulling back. So these are, I think, relevant considerations when we look at the NASDAQ 100, because right now it's right back in the region of the lower side of the range over the last 6 weeks and testing the peak from back in September. And if this trend is going to remain consistent, the NASDAQ's going to have to bounce next week. And that would certainly entail the potential that this trend is going to remain consistent. But we've had an awfully big move in bonds. And if those yields continue to march higher, well, it's going to have an additional negative effect on the growth section of the stock market. And the ARK Innovation ETF broke lower again in here today. The IPO ETF has also broken lower. So we have the really quite considerable acceleration higher in 2020, the massive reaction against the prevailing trend, a period of right-hand extension, and now it's breaking downwards again. So this is looking like a type 1-2 hybrid top formation, which has just been completed. And the question of will it be able to have the wherewithal to reverse this decline is going to be extremely dependent on these yields. So I think this is particularly important, because bond yields will eventually eat into productive capacity of the stock market. And we know what happened last time, that it took about a 20% pullback on the S&P 500, and the Federal Reserve gave up on raising rates and abandoned quantitative tightening, and soon after, stock markets rebounded and rose in an incredibly abrupt manner. And of course, then bond yields started to come back down. And all the way through 2019, we had the failed upside break of 3% right at the end of 2018.
and then the yield collapsed. And that was a very benign environment for stocks until it crashed lower in the spring of 2020. So this is obviously something that's going to have a knock-on effect for the stock market. And we're already starting to see some weakness coming through, and particularly in the most aggressively levered portions of the market, and particularly for those companies that are very heavy on liquidity on an ongoing basis. And then we've also seen that some of the major CEOs of the FANG companies have been selling. And the relative performance of the FANG index was nothing to write home about in here this week. So it's broken down from this little range that's been forming for most of the last month, and it's testing the region of the 200-day moving average. Well, I've been quite clear in stating that I don't think this big bull market is going to end until this index really breaks downwards. But it has broken down from the most recent range, and it's testing the region of the trend mean in the upper side of the underlying range. So obviously, this trend is not as consistent as it used to be. And this abrupt rise in yields is likely to contribute to a corrective phase. So then we have the potential that what we're looking at now is a change in how inflation is affecting the economy, because the Baltic Dry Index has collapsed over the course of the last 3 months. It was trading as high as 5,500. It's down now to a little bit more than 2,000. So if this trend is going to remain consistent, it will have to hold the breakout. I suspect that it will hold the breakout, but a lot of the fear stories about not enough ships around and ships costing upwards of 10 times more than they used to, well, those are more like scare stories. But we can then think about some of the commodities that are bouncing. And lumber is a big one, and it was up in a dynamic manner as well this week. And of course, the price really hasn't looked back since that big flood in Vancouver that knocked out rail and knocked out shipping lanes. So lumber prices have just been going north since then. And of course, I think that this is an object lesson in what we can anticipate from natural gas. I just don't believe it's going to come back down below the trend mean, and ultimately it's unlikely to come back down below the top of the base formation. So we often see this, that once resistance is taken out, it becomes support. And soybeans are bouncing from the upper side of the base formation. So this is beginning to ignite some interest in the fertilizer sector. And Mosaic is right at the upper side of its base formation as well. Nutrien lost their CEO this week, so the share is down, but it's still, and this is a failed upside break, so we may be in for some lengthier pause in consolidation. But as long as agriculture prices are rising and energy prices are rising, well, it's going to create demand for fertilizer. So I think there is quite likely that buying the dips is going to be a fruitful exercise in this particular sector. And then, of course, we have geopolitical tensions. The protests in Kazakhstan are being put down in a very aggressive manner. And obviously, this is weighing on Kazatomprom, and it's raising the potential that there'll be sanctions imposed against the exports of Kazakhstan. But of course, energy is the primary thing that it exports, and most particularly oil and gas. And of course, Europe needs it. What I found interesting, though, is that Cameco also pulled back really sharply on the back of this news, and one would think that it would benefit from Kazatom potentially not having the same kind of export market as it used to. Ultimately, if we're looking at weaning ourselves away from reliance on nefarious regimes like Russia for energy, and I guess regimes with expansionary ambitions like Russia, well, then domestic supply is going to have to be found. So France gets 70% of its electricity from nuclear. The UK has invested a lot of money in wind turbines, and there's the likelihood that there'll be more built. And I think these are all attempts, at least, to become energy independent. But in order to become truly independent, you need to have base load, and you need reliability of supply. And uranium and nuclear reactors achieve that. And all the other nice-to-have stuff, that helps to pad out the energy mix overall. So I think it's quite likely that the whole argument about encouraging small modular reactors, that's quite likely to be a big factor over the course of the next decade. China has been launching small modular reactors, molten salt reactors, thorium reactors over the course of the last year. They're experimenting a lot. One of the reasons why France is so efficient is because it's got a largely homogeneous fleet of nuclear reactors. So that reduces the cost of production. And ultimately, the nuclear sector will have to come up with a homogeneous design, which will be easier and cheaper to produce. And Rolls-Royce has partnered with companies to become a significant developer of nuclear technology, and the share continues to bounce from the 100 level, and it remains a significant recovery candidate, not least when the number of hours flown by airlines trends higher, because that's the service contracts for its engines are where a lot of the company's money comes from. When I think about the long term, I used to have a lot of confidence that we're in a secular bull market, and that was back in 2012 and 13. I thought that it was absolutely inevitable that globalization would deliver the potential for companies to become semi-autonomous. And we've even had an online campaign over the last couple of years to give Amazon and Facebook their own seats at the UN. So I think that was the pinnacle of globalization. But with the rise of China and the extraterritorial ambitions of Russia, well, globalization is going to become a more nuanced ambition. And I suspect there's going to be, however, a large amount of growth in demand for commodities, because as countries wish to become energy independent, and as other countries wish to exert control, and as other countries decide that they're going to try and benefit from the fraying geopolitical fabric, there's going to be a lot of infrastructure development. And I think it is the industrial companies will be among the better performers. And if we do see interest rates normalizing, well, then growth will become less attractive. And it's only the most attractive of growth candidates will be viable. And what it suggests is that ultimately it's the value propositions outside of the US will do better. And this has been a decade for the USA. And the dollar was weaker in here today and gave up its advance for the week because of some mild strength in the euro. I don't quite think yet that we're at a point where the ECB is going to aggressively remove accommodation. So we may just see some reversion towards the mean. And certainly the euro is very oversold. Ultimately, no country wants a strong currency. And I think that eventually gold will start to attract interest. And by the time this bull market has run its course, gold will have broken out to new highs in, on a purchasing power parity basis. And sorry, I don't believe that that is going to draw me the chart I want. But on a purchasing power parity basis, gold prices have been going sideways for most of the last year. And this looks like a consolidation in the region of the peaks from back in 2020 and in 2011. But in order to really demonstrate that we're back in a demand-dominated environment, it's going to have to sustain a move back above that trend mean. So the potential catalysts are that the USA does go ahead and raise rates at least once and embark upon quantitative tightening, and that China picks up the mantle for supplying liquidity to the global economy. And investors come around to the conclusion that it's going to be one central bank or another that rescues us after a 10 to 20% pullback. And of course, that would then raise the question about what exactly does the money that's being printed mean? So gold prices can rally in that environment. But of course, then the other question is, how high can these yields go? I suspect that the higher the yield goes, the greater the likelihood is that it's going to bring forward the question of capping yields. And that capping yields, or at least re-engaging with quantitative easing, is going to become much more likely if the stock market pulls back by more than 10 and probably more like 20%. And that again would be eerily similar to what we saw in 2018. So I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.